Like those moments teach the customer, you're not here to oversell them or put one over on them or hide the dirty laundry. You're there to help get them to a great decision. And so you're building up this bank of goodwill and trust. It earns you the right later to cash it in and say to your customer, you know, I don't actually think a fifth reference call is really going to be a great spend of your time. The other thing you got to do, though, this is important. You've got to demonstrate expertise. Being a trusted advisor means you've got to be trusted. So we talked about that, but you also got to be in a position to advise your customer. And far too often, you find salespeople who show up at sales calls with like the clown car of experts from their team, like the subject matter expert, the solutions engineer, the product people, the engineering team, the CS manager, the executive sponsor, you name it. And then they get on the call and they just punt.
Welcome to the B2B Digital Marketer Podcast, a podcast helping you to end your struggle with digital marketing, helping you to pave a new and better path to target and capture your ideal customer. Each week, we teach you how insiders and experts debunk the dreary and become engines of innovation. Now, here's your host, Jim Rembach.
Okay, B2B DM gang, and we're going to run for a really great discussion, but I think most importantly, just prepare yourself, you know, for a follow-up of some sort on what you're going to actually learn today, because you're going to get access to a lot of new information and hidden information. We're going to be talking about the silent killer of your B2B sales results. And, you know, we're sitting here right now and everybody's talking about recession, and then you get conflicting stories about economy results and things like that. But the fact is, we know that this silent killer is continuing to grow over time, right? So just know that. And the person who's going to help us to clear a lot of this mystery is with us today, and that's Matt Dixon. Matt, welcome.
Hey, Jim, how you doing? B2B DM gang, great to be with you today, and thanks for tuning in.
Well, I appreciate that. Now, before we get into this great discussion and you share, you know, how you were able to discover some of these mysteries, if you could tell people just a little bit of background about Matt.
Sure. Yeah. So I am a sales, marketing, and customer experience researcher. I've spent probably the last 30 years studying these topics. I am endlessly fascinated by why customers do the crazy things that they do, and what the best organizations, the best salespeople, the best marketing organizations, the best customer service organizations have figured out to engage customers more effectively. So that's what I do. I've been lucky enough to be a part of some big research projects over the years. Some people might be familiar with the Challenger Sale or the Challenger Customer. We wrote those books a number of years ago. We did a book on customer experience called The Effortless Experience. And then we've got our latest book, which we're going to talk about today, The Jolt Effect, which just came out in September. So,
it is a jolt. So for us, it's all about, you know, what is that silent killer of sales?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's the carbon monoxide poisoning of our sales results, right?
So, yeah, yeah.
Very so, point. Yeah, yeah. It is. I think it's a good analogy too. We'll talk about this, but you can't see it, you can't taste it, you can't touch it, you can't feel it. It's but it really does undermine our sales results. So here's what we found, and maybe I'll take, if it's okay with you and the listeners, Jim, I'll maybe take a step back. So back in March of 2020, which is a time I think we all remember with probably mixed emotions. We looked at a unique opportunity as sales researchers, because remember, that was a moment where sales flipped to 100% virtual, literally in the blink of an eye. All sales, the mundane calls and the important ones, were happening on Zoom and WebEx and Teams and a variety of platforms like that. So we recruited several dozen companies from across industry around the world, and we asked them, would you be willing to record your sales calls? Or if you're not already using a platform, record them, get your customers to agree to it. Or if you are using a platform like Gong or Zoom to record your calls, would you send us those recordings? And we collected about 2.5 million recorded sales calls. We transcribed those all. So we turned that audio into text, and then we use a machine learning platform from a company called Tether to mine that data. And our laser focus in doing that study was to try to understand this silent killer. So what is the silent killer? This is something we've been tracking for a while, but it wasn't until the study that we could really get our arms around it, which is the no decision loss. So really specifically, we're talking about customers who go through oftentimes the entire purchase process. And for some of your listeners,
that could be weeks, that could be months, that could be years, right? To sell, especially really complex and disruptive solutions to a customer, it takes a long time. And think about all the resources that your team, the supplier, the vendor, pours into pursuing those opportunities, to say nothing of the customer's time and the time of all their colleagues and their legal and their finance and procurement, you know, all the sales prevention departments on the customer side. So all the investment of that time and energy sunken into opportunities that end up going nowhere. And what's really interesting about this is that the vast majority of them are opportunities where the customer will say, we're sold. Like, we're in, we're convinced of the value. We're convinced that our status quo is suboptimal, and they still disengage. They go radio silent. They go dark on us. They disengage. We chase them for a while. We hold out hope. We send them the email. We try to float it to the top of their inbox. We get our boss to leave a voicemail. You know, we do all this stuff, these Hail Mary passes, but the deal is gone, right? It's evaporated. It's lost to this wasteland of no decision. Eventually we mark it as closed, lost, no decision. It actually, I've told people, it reminds me of my dating life in college. Like, the relationship was over. It just took me a long time to figure it out. And but sometimes sales can feel like that. But if you think about this, what we found is there's a killer to salespeople, and it's huge. Anywhere between 40 and 60% of the average salesperson's qualified pipeline will be lost to no decision. And so if you think about that at an individual basis or across a team or across an entire commercial organization, I mean, the impact of that is disastrous. And as you mentioned before, in this current environment, it feels like this is happening a lot more often. Customers kicking cans down the road, getting cold feet, disengaging, going radio silent. Felt like a sure thing 6 months ago. Now it's not such a sure thing, and our customer just kind of pulls the plug and ghosts us.
Well, and as part of that, you know, that research, and I want to point out too, when you started talking about the mass number, you know, you're talking about billions of observations, and I know a lot of these studies that I come across, they're like, well, we essentially gathered information from, you know, this small sample size. I mean, this is almost what we refer to in research terms, darn close to a census.
It's huge. Yeah, it's really big. And, you know, for us, it was, I think many of your listeners are familiar with Neil Rackham's seminal work in spin selling. You remember Neil and his team, they spent a decade, a team of 12 people, traveling the world, sitting in on sales conversations. It literally, like, sitting right next to a salesperson in the client's office with a clipboard, taking notes. And they studied 35,000, I think, sales interactions. So this is almost like an homage to that, but using modern technology and the benefit that the pandemic brought, where sales was virtual. You know, we may never see this time again. So it was a really big study, but it's so fascinating as a researcher to see where we were back in the 70s and 80s when Neil and his team did that fantastic work, and where we are today with modern technology. It's just like, I was like a kid in a candy store. I mean, it was fun working with all that data and this modern tech to try to understand it.
Well, and I want to be quite clear, is that people should not misconstrue the fact that if you are in one of those types of organizations, that now you're getting a chance to do a little bit more face-to-face.
Mm-hmm.
What's learned still is heavily impacted by anything that you do going forward. And
Yeah, you know, it's a really good point. This comes up a lot, actually. We'll talk about more about the Jolt Effect and what we learned. People sometimes ask, do you think that the results are biased by the fact that it was virtual? And I say, if anything, I think the impact that we saw, which was huge, and we're going to talk more about this, of some of these behaviors, was muted by the fact that it was on Zoom. I think doing this face-to-face would be even more impactful and bring even better results.
That's an interesting point. Okay, so in here you talk, as part of these findings, in order to categorize and dissect and then get down into the psychology of all of this, you talk about a couple biases that are, you talk about the errors of commission versus the errors of omission.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
Yeah. So, I'll take one step back, which is first to level set around why most salespeople have been taught a deal gets lost to no decision. And I think in sales, and this is true, you know, you pick up any sales book, including the ones we've written in the past, and Challenger Sales, Challenger Customer, and we talk about the status quo bias that the customer has. We all are familiar with this in sales. And what we found is that, you know, if you think about a simple purchase process, the customer is in their status quo. It's the way they do things today. Maybe they don't use your product. They use a homegrown solution. Maybe they use a competitor's product. Maybe they do use your product, but they use it in a narrow sense and you want them to use it enterprise-wide. The first step is get them to agree to leave the status quo behind and move forward with us as a partner in a new way. And then the last step is get them to sign, you know, go from I want this to I bought this, right? We got to get them to sign on the dotted line, execute that DocuSign.
what we found in our study is there's this point where things start to go sideways, and it's usually between where the customer says, I want this and I bought this. And when that happens, because salespeople have been taught, the only reason that that could happen is because you haven't convinced the customer to leave their status quo. Because the status quo, we've all been told, is our biggest, if not only, enemy in professional sales. So what do we see? We see salespeople go back and they do one of three things. They try to reconvince the customer of the value of the of making the decision, right? Jim, you know, did you see how many zeros were on that ROI projection? This is going to be huge for you and your business. Like, you don't want to miss out on this golden opportunity. If that doesn't sway you, what I go to is the FUD, right? The fear, uncertainty, and doubt. I try to create that burning platform, give you no choice but to abandon ship and move forward. You know, hey, Jim, we work with all your competitors. I got to tell you, they're experiencing tremendous gains, and you're going to be left behind with this terrible status quo that you told me 6 months ago you're really dissatisfied with, and it's leading to lost top line growth, cost leakage, risk, et cetera. If those two things don't work, we usually see the salesperson resort to the 10% discount that's only good this quarter, you know, but they're all kind of flavors of the same thing. They're designed to beat the status quo. It's all about dialing up the FOMO, the fear of missing out. Now, you talked about the errors of omission and commission. This is pretty interesting. When we went into the data, we found that that playbook, that FOMO playbook, with customers who have expressed their desire to leave the status quo and their desire to work with you as a solution provider, if they've stated their intent, going back and then they start to wobble, going back and trying to dial up the FOMO actually makes things worse, not better. It backfires like 84% of the time. It increases the odds the deal will be lost to no decision. But it's a head scratcher, right? Because this flies in the face of everything we've talked about in sales for many years. What else? What other reason could there be? Until we actually dug into the data, and here's what we found. We found there are actually two reasons a deal can be lost to no decision. The first one is the one we all know. The customer prefers their status quo, or maybe they don't love it, but they think it's good enough. Or maybe they just don't see solving this problem as a big priority in their business. You haven't convinced them of the urgency and that this is really something you got to get after right away. That's status quo bias. But there's a second bias called the omission bias, which we'll talk about, which really is rooted in the customer's fear of failure. And what we found is when you run the numbers, it's the customer's fear of failure that drives more no decision losses than the customer's preference for the status quo. The fear of failure is so powerful because of what you just talked about, this omission commission thing. This has to do with the great work by Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky and all the great Nobel Prize winners, the fathers and grandfathers of and grandmothers of behavioral economics out there who have given us all this research around why we do the things that we do as human beings. One of the things that Kahneman and Tversky found in their research, we all know this in sales, people hate to lose. They hate to lose more than they like to win. But there's a wrinkle here that's really important. There are two types of loss. One is an error of omission. An error of omission is when you lose through inaction. You experience a loss because you did nothing. You sat on the sidelines, you sat on the fence, you didn't take it, you didn't move, you didn't make a decision, and you experienced some loss as a result. That is because you failed to do something right. You failed to capitalize on a golden opportunity. And then there's an error of commission. Error of commission is very different. This is where you experience a loss by doing something, not by doing nothing, but by doing something. You made a decision, you chose a course of action, and it led to some loss, which is definitionally attributed to the decision you made, right? So you are personally responsible. That's called an error of commission. The omission bias holds that between those two things, people care a heck of a lot more about messing up than they do about missing out. And this is why that FOMO playbook fails to sway people to move forward, because it's not FOMO they're worried about, it's FOMU, the fear of messing up. And what we found in the research is that great salespeople understand this. There is a time and a place, especially early on in the sale. You've got to beat the status quo. If you don't convince a customer that what they're doing today is suboptimal, they're never going to move forward. You're not going to sell a thing. And then indecision is not even a problem you have to worry about. But once they're convinced of that, they start worrying about a different set of things that are all rooted in their worries about risk and about making the wrong decision and about having this hanging on their name and reputation. And potentially in today's environment, meaning they lose their job, right? Or stymie their career in some way. The three fears of failure we found were one, have I picked the right thing? You are talking about a solution. You've put a lot in front of me, lots of bells and whistles and different options, configuration options. And then there's all the stuff your competitors do. Like, what is important to be in this solution and not in the solution? Like, how do I choose, especially when I'm not an expert and this stuff all sounds the same to me? It's all, you know, it all looks the same and I can't really detect the differences. In that environment where everything looks good, it's better to do nothing, right? To just sit on the sidelines and not make the wrong choice.
The second fear of failure is I haven't done enough research. There's a lack of information. And my fear is that, Jim, after I make that decision and we roll out your solution, we might get surprised. Some new Gartner analyst report comes out, or so I talk to somebody else in my LinkedIn network, or we learn, turns out your solution doesn't really integrate with this legacy system we had. And if we had just done a little bit more research, we would have figured that out before we bought it, right? And now I've got egg on my face because I was the one who was supposed to do all this research and leave no stone unturned, and I didn't. And then the last fear of failure is that we're not going to get what we're paying for. We might not see the benefits of this solution. Yeah, you're projecting a 5x ROI. And look, I don't even blame you. I trust you. You guys sound great. But you don't understand, our company screws everything up. There's no way we could get a 5x ROI. That's impossible, you know? And I just don't feel like I have a safety net. And look, I can't put my badge on the table and lobby for this big purchase and then get dragged in the CFO's office in a few months and have that person ask me, like, where are the benefits? Like, we're not getting what we paid for. I need the assurance that this is going to go well and I'm going to look like a hero, not like a fool. So those things are the things that keep customers from moving forward. And again, hopefully it becomes clear now to listeners, if you're just dangling a 10% discount in front of your customer, it turns out they care a lot more about losing their job than they do about getting your discount. So that's really what this boils down to.
Well, and that's a perfect explanation. And so that's kind of where you were talking about in the book. You said that there's two different playbooks that sellers have to be playing from in order to address, the FOMO issue, which is, okay, that's the status quo playbook. And then the other is to address the FOMO, which, by the way, I asked for a rewrite. I don't want to use FOMO. I want to use...
Oh, yeah, you had a better one. Go ahead, tell the listeners what it was. I always like, I had, Jim, when you told me this, I had a total, I'm going to date myself. You had a V8 moment. I slapped myself before it. I was like, damn, I should have thought of that.
FOMO. And FOMO is the fear of effing up. my G rating, so I don't want to use it most.
Yeah. But then, it was me. Look, we were writing for a family audience here, Jim, so we couldn't go with this. That was a great one.
That's exactly right. So we'll save that one for the private audience.
Yeah. The director's cut.
But it's so true. It's like, and we've all gone through it. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can call it buyer's remorse. Psychologists call it different things, but ultimately we have to have these two playbooks. And what I also found interesting in the research is that, we need to do a good job, and you have a nice little graph, stating that we need to actually use the one playbook, which is, the status quo bias breaking book.
Yes.
Start dialing that down and then turning up the other one.
Yes. Yeah. This is a really important thing, I think, for listeners, is that we are not arguing in this book that you should take, if you're a Challenger shop, you should junk that. Or if you're a Medic shop, you should stop doing that. If you're a Sandler shop, you should stop doing that. In fact, if anything, what I would argue is you need to double down on that and become world-class at breaking the status quo bias. It's always step one. But as you're saying, once we start to accomplish that, that stuff leaves the customer's mind. And what starts coming into the customer's mind is their FOFU, right? Their FOMU, all that stuff. And that's now what we got to deal with. So you got to switch from breaking the status quo bias, beating the status quo, to overcoming customer indecision. And look, best salespeople understand that it's a two-part playbook. It's not just one thing. There's not only one enemy in sales. Again, we've always been taught the status quo is your biggest, if not only, enemy. We found that it's not either of those things. It's not your biggest one, nor is it your only enemy, but it's still a really important one. So we got to do both.
Well, and that's where the JOLT method comes into play. And we're going to that in a second, but as you're saying that, a lot of this, because you were talking about actually taking all these conversations, there's things that happen within those conversations.
Yes.
If you don't build your skills upon, you miss out on. So like, for example, you may have done a really good job at the whole status quo bias breaking thing, and then a customer says to you, I'm sold, right? Mm-hmm. That should be a trigger for you to say, okay, I need to start now turning up the other one.
Exactly. If anything, it might tell you that it's too late. You should have started planting the seeds of so, because it's a gradual, it's not a binary kind of on-off switch. But as you described it and the way we position that graphic is, there's stuff you can do in the very first call to start surfacing, this individual, this organization, have they been burned in the past? Is there heightened budget scrutiny? Are they going to spin their wheels with research? Like, how are they describing how the purchase journey is going to unfold? What's the baggage they're bringing to the table? So we can start detecting those things really early. But you're right. When they say you're sold, if you're not already working on that overcoming indecision playbook, you might be too late. But if you're not, you got to start at that point, right? Because they are sold rationally, right? They're sold that this is the right answer for the business.
but they're not sold emotionally because they do not want to be the one holding the bag, especially in this environment where people lose their jobs for decisions like this that go sideways.
Well, absolutely. Okay. So now the JOLT method.
Yeah.
That's, of course, it's an acronym.
Yep.
But, you know, for us, it helps us to remember and follow, is that we need to judge the indecision.
Mm-hmm.
We need to offer your recommendation.
Yep.
We need to limit the exploration. And then we need to take risks off the table. Now, as you were explaining, you hit all those points, right? But if you could, you know, just kind of wrap in a nice wrapper, talk about what is the JOLT effect?
Yeah. So it is an acronym, as you laid out. We did that for a couple of reasons. One, we're trying to, you know, do our maybe poor man's imitation of Neil Rackham with Spin Selling, but I think, you know, he just did a brilliant job there. But we like it because it helps salespeople remember, but it also, it speaks to what's happening, right? It's an action term. We're trying to move our customer from their stuck, indecisive state. What we found is not to, you know, we'll talk about more of that, about these behaviors, but what's interesting is when we look at salespeople who deploy the four behaviors in the JOLT method versus those who don't, so JOLT sellers versus non-JOLT sellers, and then we look at the opportunities and we array them across a continuum of, you know, the decisive customers, because there are some of those out there, the moderately indecisive customers, and then the deeply indecisive customers. What we find is that JOLT sellers convert a little bit less. It's like 1.8x the conversion rate on the decisive customer. So when fear of failure is not an issue, everyone's good at sales, including people like me who just write about sales. Everyone's good at it. It's easy, right? But still, JOLT sellers do better there. Then when things start to get tough with those moderately indecisive customers, their conversion rate is double. It's a 26% average for non-JOLT sellers. It's 57% for JOLT sellers. And then when customers become deeply indecisive, it's a 5x multiple. So average performers, non-JOLT sellers convert at 6% with those customers. JOLT sellers convert at 31%. And so this is, you think about the cost we talked about before, the silent killer, and how much that means to us as an individual seller, as a sales leader, as a CEO or a business leader across our commercial organization. And then you look at that win rate differential. And then you think about today's economy where everyone's kicking the can down the road. Like the answer to higher performance is in this playbook. And what's cool about it, just like Challenger, we didn't invent this. High performers already figured that out on their own. We just gave language and kind of a playbook around it, but we can't take credit for it. It was gifted sellers who kind of figured this out on their own, that it's more than beating the status quo. Now I need to instill the confidence that the customer's made a great decision, that they should feel great about moving forward. We've got their back. They're going to look like a hero, not like a fool, and they're not going to be left hanging out to dry.
Well, that's what researchers do, right, Matt?
Yep.
it was there, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
There, you just need to do it. And another thing, as you were talking about you essentially categorized, purchasers into three particular groups.
Mm-hmm.
What I also like about this is that you're talking about those organizations and individuals that are extremely indecisive.
Yeah.
As a seller, I need to make a decision on whether or not I spend time with them.
Oh yeah. Time is your scarcest resource as a salesperson. And sometimes it feels like you don't get enough opportunities, but I would argue that it's time, right? In best sellers, we've known this for a very long time, that best sellers don't chase garbage trucks, right? They're very decisive, you know, pun intended, but they make those hard decisions about disqualification. They actually disqualify very aggressively. And, you know, look, even if we're not talking about that extreme situation of like, there is no way we'll ever get this customer to move forward on this purchase. And they're moderately indecisive, or there's some indecision. Well, that's really important too, because it tells us, how do we forecast this deal? Do I want to tell my boss it's going to close next week, or is this a next quarter deal or next year deal? And if we know there's some indecision, well, what's the playbook we're going to run to overcome it? Because there's different types of indecision. There's the, what should I purchase? There's, I haven't done enough research. There's the, I don't know if we're going to get the benefits from this. So those each have different treatments, which is what we talk about in the JOLT playbook.
Absolutely. Okay. So you talk about, or you state judging indecision.
Yeah.
Vital, the first acronym letter to the actual mm-hmm. going forward process, and that you need to build your skills and pin
yep.
the sources, you know, of indecision. So, I mean, how does
yeah.
somebody go about doing it?
So there's two ways to do that. One of which we actually talk about in the book. The other one is not in the book, but I'll share with your listeners. We found this because, again, this is a huge data set. So the publisher wasn't going to wait. So we sent the manuscript, but then we kept learning things. And this is one of those things that, man, I wish we'd hit pause and put it in the book, because a lot of people think this is pretty cool. The first thing I think is kind of obvious, which is we've got to tune our active listening so that we're picking up on the signs of indecision. Some of your listeners, if you haven't seen this, go check out on the internet, Google the upside down plate meme. Jim, you may know what I'm talking about here, but there's this thing that's going around the internet like wildfire. And it says at the top, it says all of the paper plates in this picture are upside down. And you look at these paper plates and they all look upside down. And the bottom, it says, except for one, if you combine the one that's right side up, then look at all the plates again. And what happens is they all look right side up. And it's this total mental trick. But what's so interesting, I tell people when they read The Jolt Effect, put all the skills aside. The most important thing is that you now know, and knowing, it turns out, is more than half the battle here, that you know that we lose to fear of failure a lot. Now you're going to see it everywhere. You know, and I hear this from sellers all the time, but boy, I can't believe I missed that. All the signs they were giving me, I thought it was a sign of goodness that they wanted to keep doing research. They were actually suffering from analysis paralysis. I didn't know, you know, that, and they were worried about being surprised after the fact, or when they said this, that's what they really meant. They meant they were worried about looking bad to their boss. And that's not how I read it at the time, but now you know. So active listening obviously is critical. The other thing, this is not in the book, we found a technique, we call it pings and echoes, that high performers use to surface indecision. Because there's this funny thing about fear of failure, which is people don't like talking about it. If you ask your customer, they're going to say, I'm very decisive. I'm a decisive leader, a decisive executive. The data says it tells a very different story. We found that 87% of customers, 2.5 million sales calls, 87% of those calls had customers displaying either moderate or high levels of indecision. The decisive customers, there aren't a lot of them out there, 13% of the market. So you can't disqualify your way to victory here. You got to deal with indecision. But people don't want to talk about it. So how do you get it on the table so we can talk about it? We borrowed this term from submarine warfare, which is, I'm not a sailor, but I'll tell you, when a surface ship goes to detect a submarine in the water, they'll send out a ping in the water, right? A sound, right? And what they're listening for is a reflection back. The reflection is going to tell them, is that a submarine or is it a whale or a rock formation? If it is a submarine, is it an enemy submarine? Is it heading toward me or away from me? Is it opening its torpedo doors and waiting to do me harm? That submarine is customer indecision waiting to torpedo your deal. So what a high performer will do is they'll send out that signal and they'll say, you know, Jim, and what that is doing is designed to articulate what I think you're worried about, but do it in a safe way that's not embarrassing and makes it okay to talk about it. So Jim, we've been talking a lot and we've thrown a lot at you. We've done a lot of demos. We did a POC. We introduced you to some of our partners, our professional services team. And I'm getting the sense right now that maybe you're wringing your hands a little bit about what should be in the proposal and what shouldn't be. And it kind of looks like a buffet where everything looks good, but you can't have it all, right? Because budgets are tight and you got to make principled decisions about how to start. I just want to let you know, every single customer who ends up doing business with us has this problem at this point in the sales process. So if you are worried about that, totally normal. And I'd like to have a really frank dialogue about how we make those hard decisions. And I'm here to help and guide you. And I've got a point of view about what I would say yes to and some of the stuff that I know you were interested in that I honestly don't think is a great use of your money right now. Let's have that dialogue. Now, what that's going to do is it's either going to confirm, yeah, Matt, that actually is a big problem. We cannot make the wrong decision here. I will get, you know, I'll be like raked over the coals by the CFO if we spend our money in the wrong place. Or you might deny. You might say, no, actually, that's not it at all, Matt. It's we know what we want to buy. It's getting the ROI. Like, I just don't think I can put a business case in front of my CFO for 5x ROI. Never going to happen. Just you don't understand our organization. We're not going to be able to accomplish that. So that's a really powerful technique, because what I've done is I've benchmarked it. I've said everyone else worries about this too. Let's talk about it. I've articulated it so you don't have to. And then it gets that confirm or deny. Then we know what we're working with, right? It's this thing that's gone from carbon monoxide that we can't see or touch or feel to something we can actually deal with. So that technique, again, not in the book, but a very powerful technique to get these fears on the table so they can be dealt with.
I mean, to me, you just actually gave an excellent, sales script example of how to actually go about doing that. So for me, talking about transcripts, I think we'll be taking the transcript. So we have to judge that indecision. And you also, even in the book, we're not going to get into it, but mm-hmm. we actually will take and create scorecards based off of that.
Yeah, you certainly can. You know, look, if there's a lot more in the book about doing that. There's also a lot in the book we talk about in that J chapter, judging the indecision, about the different human biases. There's different levels that we're going to look for. We're going to look for, like, what are you worried about around this purchase? Is it you don't know what to choose? You haven't done enough research, or you don't think you're going to get the returns on this purchase? There's also individual predispositions we all have, like you and I and everyone, all the listeners. We all have different biases as humans that make us more or less indecisive. Whether it's picking what movie to watch on Friday night with your kids, or it's making a $1 million purchase from a vendor. These are biases that impact how likely we are and how comfortable we are with ambiguity and taking a leap of faith and these kinds of things. And so we talk a lot about kind of scorecards that salespeople can use to try to pinpoint, what kind of company am I working with here? What's the decisiveness culture or indecisiveness culture, as it were? What about this individual? And what about the specific purchase that I'm trying to get them to make a decision on? And all that stuff feeds into our calculus about what is the level of indecision and what do we do about it?
Okay, so now to be successful, you talk about offering,
yeah,
recommendation, and that you actually need to develop two skills in order to be effective.
Right, exactly. So what I would do is maybe start with a analogy. And maybe just take a step back. What most salespeople do, we love saying yes, right? We love letting 1,000 flowers bloom, like painting the art of the possible. Yes, we can do that. Yes, we can do this. Yeah, we have an integration with that and this and the other thing. We love saying yes. But in a world of yes, the customer really struggles with, what do I say no to, right? Like, because they can't have it all. And what average salespeople do in that moment is they'll kind of voice the decision back on the customer. Well, Jim, why don't you tell me why you first reached out to us? What are you trying to accomplish here? What's most important to you? And what my hope is, like, I don't want to bias you and I don't want to steer you the wrong way. I want you to figure out what you want to buy, what should be in and out of the proposal. But it's a little bit like going to a restaurant and looking at like 20 great entrees, and you ask the waiter or waitress, what should I order? What's good here? And they say, well, Jim, what are you in the mood to eat tonight? Which is super unhelpful. What you'd rather they do is say, this is my favorite dish. Here's another option if you're not quite as hungry, but everything we make here is great. And what happens in that moment is something called the delegation effect, which is the blame or responsibility for a bad choice shifts a little bit from the decider to the recommender. And the same is true, not just in ordering in a restaurant or picking a movie for movie night. It's the same thing in B2B purchases. We find that when great salespeople can not just diagnose needs, actually use two skills. One is guidance. So I'm going to go take you from everything down to a narrower consideration set, from 20 options down to maybe the two or three I think you should really consider. And then I'm going to put my personal seal of approval on one. I'm going to say, Jim, based on what I've gotten to know about your organization and my work with other companies just like yours, I'd recommend option B. I really think that's the way to go forward. You're going to love it. You're not going to look back. And we could always expand and tweak it as we move forward and work together. We're hoping this is the beginning of a long-term relationship. Now, when I do that, you're saying, boy, that this is like, if this goes sideways, it's kind of your fault too. Now, granted, you know, I'm not going to get fired by your CFO, but you feel more comfort because I'm walking in lockstep there. I'm endorsing that choice versus just saying like, hey, it's on you, right? So great salespeople execute those two skills to narrow up the consideration set and get the customer to actually pick something.
Well, and here's one little trick that I actually learned, you know, mm-hmm. reading in the research, is if you took what you were saying there and actually did a little bit of a tweak or a twist and said, well, so if you're dealing with a male, you would say, well, if you were my brother, this is mm-hmm. what I would recommend to him.
That is a great, I love that. In the book, you know, we talk about the idea that you almost want to think about, what if this were your best friend, or like you're saying, a sibling, or you know, your neighbor, somebody right across the table, what would you tell them to do? There's something we're talking about, the L here. Maybe we could jump over that because I think we're starting to bleed into a little bit there. L is limit the exploration, of course. I find, and this is true of all the skills, but especially with this one, in a world where customers want to become an expert. And look, they're never going to know as much as we do about our marketplace, our technology, our competitive set, our solution, right? They don't work for us. They work for their company. But they want to try. They want to try to consume as much information as possible. And the analysis paralysis effect is very real. What's interesting about that is when customers ask for more, I want another reference call. I want another demo. I want to do another POC in another part of the business. I want to wait till the next Gartner Magic Quadrant report comes out next quarter before I move a muscle. What the average salesperson hears is a customer moving towards the finish line. You know, they're engaged. They're asking the right questions. They want to learn more. That's great, right? It could be worse. They could be ghosting me. They're engaged. They're plugged in. What high performers know is that beyond a certain point, some amount of education and learning is normal. Beyond a certain point, though, it tips over into just consumption and research for consumption's sake. And that's a bad thing. And your conversion rate in those situations is dramatically lower, as we found in the data. But how do you get the customer to stop trying to be an expert and start trusting you as an expert? There's two pieces of that. One you hit on here and we talked about, which is you got to be a trusted advisor. We all know this in sales. Specifically, you need to build a bank of goodwill or bank of trust. And one of the ways you do that is you do operate as a seller as if it's your brother or your sister or your neighbor or your friend on the other side of the table. And you got to take specific moments to say, you know, Jim, I know you're looking at the premium version of our solution. Trust me, I'd love to sell it to you. You'd probably make my year. I think the basic version is going to be fine for you guys. You know, or, you know, I know you want to do roll this out enterprise-wide, but that's going to take a long time to get approval there. It's going to put a lot of pressure on you to deliver returns immediately because of how much money you're spending. Why don't we start a little smaller? Why don't we roll it out here, get some runs on the board, experience some success and some lessons learned together, and then expand from there. Or, you know what? And we found this in the sales calls. Jim, I'd love to add you as a logo to our logo sheet. You guys are a great company. We'd love to be honored to have you as a customer. But I can be honest, based on what you're looking for, we're actually not the best vendor in the market for that. It's those guys over there. And in fact, I know people over there. I'd be happy to introduce you. Like those moments teach the customer, you're not here to oversell them or put one over on them or hide the dirty laundry. You're there to help get them to a great decision. And so you're building up this bank of goodwill and trust. It earns you the right later to cash it in and say to your customer, you know, I don't actually think a fifth reference call is really going to be a great spend of your time. The other thing you got to do, though, this is important. You've got to demonstrate expertise. Being a trusted advisor means you've got to be trusted. So we talked about that, but you also got to be in a position to advise your customer. And far too often, you find salespeople who show up at sales calls with like the clown car of experts from their team, like the subject matter expert, the solutions engineer, the product people, the engineering team, the CS manager, the executive sponsor, you name it. And then they get on the call and they just punt. Say, well, I brought along Jim. Jim's our chief product officer. Jim, take it away. But something really dangerous happens in that moment, which is the customer might love it. They might love that I got them on the phone with Jim and Jim knows all the ins and outs of the product. Answer, you can go really deep on the technical detail. But what happens in that moment is that I am seen as a glorified MC or an admin, right? And I get delegated down to who I sound like. In a world where the customer perceives the salesperson as not knowing a heck of a lot more about this decision than they know, that's a recipe for doing a lot of your own research. It's no different from, Jim, if I were to plan a trip to a foreign country that I'd never been to before, why would I trust a travel agent who'd never planned a trip for anybody else, never been there themselves, nor had they ever planned a successful trip for any other traveler to that destination? I wouldn't. I'd go do first of all, I'd probably go hire a different travel agent, but I'd probably do a lot of my own research. I'm going to go to TripAdvisor. I'm going to buy guidebooks. I'm going to read blog posts, right? Your customer feels like they're not being guided by anybody who knows what they're talking about. So we've got to instill that confidence that we're not putting one over on you. Our goal is to get you in a great decision. And I know what I'm talking about here. I've sold the same solution to other customers and they've been thrilled with it. And it doesn't mean you don't rely on subject matter experts. It just means you don't punt to those people. So you got to carefully orchestrate and use it more of as a surgical weapon, if you will, or surgical tool in your sales conversations, not just, you know, and again, forgive the militaristic analogies, but you don't want to be carpet bombing your customer with like, and just handing over the conversation to all the experts on your side.
Yeah, definitely not. And that makes total sense. Another thing that you had said, and there was actually some statistics behind it, where a study said that more information actually drives indecision up by like 16%+.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right.
I also have a lot of people misapply certain data out there. Like, for example, you see it all over where it's like customers do so much research online, you know, 86% of their decision is already made by the time they reach out. And I'm like, oh, that's misapplied.
Mm-hmm.
In proper context.
You know, we find this in consumer for sure. You also find it in B2B, but you're right. You need the proper context. When you think about it from a salesperson's perspective, it's tough, right? Because we talk about this in the challenger sale and the challenger customer, where when that customer shows up and having done a lot of research, whether it's a ton or it's just a little, it puts you in a tough spot because they've kind of already decided what they're trying to do and how you fit into the, you know, addressing their needs. And now you're, as a salesperson, you got to undo a lot of that. And by the way, a lot of the stuff they learned is probably untrue, right? So it puts us in a tough spot. But you're also going to avoid the opposite, which is just like feeding the beast and having them over consume. Because as you said, and the research is very clear, more information is not necessarily better. The customer wants us to be a buyer's agent, right? They don't want us to just sell to them. They want us to be a buyer's agent. How do we guide them to a great decision? Like a great travel agent. So we come back and say, I am never going to go anywhere else without working with you because my family had the greatest time ever. I feel like it was great value for what we paid. This was brilliant. I look like a hero. I'm dad of the year. You know, this is amazing. You saved my bacon here. And I think that's kind of the impression we want to give our customer. That's what we're here for, right? We're here to put them on a pedestal, make them look like a hero, get them to a great decision. And sometimes we got to put aside how those decisions will impact what we'll get paid, right? Sometimes it is advising them to start a little bit smaller. Sometimes it is advising them, like, you don't need the premium version. The basic version is just fine.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, sales is actually the outcome of all of these other factors, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So we talked about, you know, offering recommendation and then limiting exploration. That's what we were talking about there. And so then what we would need to be able to do is to take risk off the table.
Yep.
And you had mentioned one thing about the unskilled approach. table. Talk a little bit about what the bestsellers do.
Yeah. So I think the first thing I'll say about this deals with that outcome uncertainty. Like, are we really going to get all the benefits you're projecting, or am I going to look like I hauled into the CFO's office and have some explaining to do when we don't realize those benefits? You know, have you established a safety net? Do I feel like you've got my back here? There's two things I'd say about that. One is the seeds of outcome uncertainty are actually planted really early in the sales process. Sometimes people hear this and they think it's like a final stage negotiating thing. It partly is late stage, but it's also early stage. And that is in the form of managing proper expectations with your customer. Look, even if you on your website have proof points and case studies and customer success stories that have amazing, outlandish, gaudy ROI, like $100 million saved and like 100x ROI and all these things, that's great. That's like eye candy, but don't fall victim into building the customer's business case around that. What you found is that we looked at individual companies and we found is average salespeople way overstate the high. They believe the more I promise, the bigger kind of pot of gold I paint for you at the end of the rainbow, the more excited you're going to be about moving forward. What high performers know is that's really kind of marketing eye candy. And my goal is to get you anchored on what you will see at least, right? So you at least see a 5x ROI. Yeah, we have this case study on the website. I love it. I know those guys, 25x ROI, amazing, but everything went right. I'd much rather we build the business case on a 5x ROI. By the way, the CFO, your CFO, I guarantee you, is not seeing a lot of proposals that have that kind of ROI. And here's the thing, we see that in every single customer deployment, at least a 5x ROI. And I'm like hugely confident we're gonna do way better than that. And then you're going to look like a hero. So I think we're going to do probably 10x. Well, let's build a business case on a 5x. Let's be conservative. So you plant the seeds early, but then you also have to deal with it late. We want to create that safety net. And I think a lot of salespeople hear this and they're like, well, I can't give an opt-out clause. That's obviously the ultimate safety net, right? If you don't like it, you get your money back, or you cancel the agreement, tear it up. And a lot of companies, especially in B2B, don't offer that. Consumer, it's much more common, right? But we don't see it. We don't see it nearly as much in B2B. But that doesn't mean there's nothing you can do. There's a lot you can do. You can create a mutual value plan. Jim, you know, I know the agreement's in legal and they're reviewing and crossing T's and dotting I's, and we'll get to the agreement eventually. What I'd like to do, though, is start planning for a rollout together. Let me get you on the phone with our team. And what I'd like to do is walk you through our value plan. It has owners, milestones, metrics, stage gates, checkpoints. It's our recipe for guaranteeing that you're going to get tremendous value out of the solution. And so let's start thinking about who owns what and what's the right timing and resources. And let's start thinking one step ahead. Our goal is not to get the signed agreement. Our goal is to deliver tremendous value and having you want to buy more from us. So let's start that conversation right now. That feels really good to the customer. It feels like a great safety net, a backup parachute, right? There's other stuff we can do. I mentioned starting small. Like, I know you want the enterprise-wide solution. Let's start a little bit smaller. Adding professional services for those listeners who are in software or technology-based businesses, where you do have a consulting group or a professional services group. We found high performers sell a lot more professional services. That shouldn't surprise folks because they sell more of everything, but it was the way they positioned that. They positioned it as an insurance policy to the customer. You know, Jim, I know you guys want to roll this out yourself, and that's a beautiful thing about our product is you can do it on your own. We've got the videos, we got the CS team, everyone's there to help. We've got a tremendous customer portal and a community of customers there to help each other. It's wonderful. You could totally DIY it. However, what I don't want to do is have this go sideways and have that be reflect poorly upon you. So I would encourage you to add, maybe we call it 100 professional services hours to this agreement. If we don't use them, we'll roll it into the renewal, right? But that way the team is lined up. We've carved out the capacity. In case this slips, we swarm the problem, get you back up on track, get things going. Don't skip a beat, right? So those kinds of assurances feel really good to the customer. It feels like I'm working with a partner who is invested in my success. Is not going to leave me holding the bag. They're not pushing me out of the plane without a chute. It's like a tandem skydiving instructor strapped to my back, and we're ready to go.
Well, this is pretty powerful all the way through this particular interview. Man, I'll tell you, this transcript's going to be phenomenal. Okay. We wrapped it up, said judge the indecision, offer your recommendation, limit the expiration, and then take risk off the table.
You got it. Yeah.
But I think one of the things I think it's important that we make sure that we cover in here is that, you know, an organization really needs to determine how much indecision is costing them. How do they-
Right. Yeah. So there's lots of different ways to do that. I think there's low tech and high tech. I think the lowest low tech, but everyone can do it, is kind of manual call auditing, or, you know, riding shotgun and sitting in on your seller's calls and using that kind of, that's more of on a sample basis, right? Because a manager can't be on every single call, but sitting in and auditing those calls so you can get a second set of ears, maybe a more trained set of ears, a manager's set of ears or a leader's set of ears on what the customer is saying, to be able to quantify that, and then taking that as a baseline and multiplying it across the entirety of your pipeline, across your sales team. You could do customer surveys, more of like a win-loss survey, but not waiting till the end, but deployed in the process of the deal to find out how confident the customer feels, what might be holding them up, agreement, scale kind of questions, get a sense for where is the indecision here. And again, then multiply it out, because you won't get 100% response rate. And then the way we did it was we collected recorded calls, and we used machine learning to measure that. So there's a lot of different ways to do it, but I think it is important for folks to think about what this is actually costing them. Look, in the current environment, I'm hearing a lot of commercial leaders just focus on leads. How do I get more in the top of the funnel? Right? I need more leads. We need more opportunities. What I'm telling people is, look, where 40 to 60% of your deals are lost to no decision, the answer isn't more leads. The answer is in converting more of those and getting them moving forward, jolting them into action, right? The keys to victory are sitting right there in your funnel right now. Yes, you should drive demand up above the funnel, drive more leads. But what about all the opportunities that you spent weeks, months, some cases years pursuing, and they're just stuck? What if you could execute a different playbook to get them unstuck? And that's really what we're talking about here.
Well, you know, you talk about insights and information. I think there's really important pieces of insight that organizations should be capturing once, like you said, that DocuSign is signed.
Yeah.
Is that we ask the question, what almost caused you not to buy?
Yeah, that's a great question. By the way, I guarantee you, like, nobody asked that question. There's nobody. That's like, why would I want to dredge up like the bad feelings, right? But it's so instructive, isn't it? If you could learn, what were the things that almost derailed this? Why wouldn't you have done this? I know you did, but why wouldn't it have happened? Great question.
Okay, so we're talking about Jolt, and we talked about, you know, B2B, and, you know, for me, we focus in on high ticket B2B, but Jolt actually can be used in a lot of different types of sales.
Yeah, this is a human thing. This the FOMO versus the FOMO. This is the same reason it's taken me, like, and I'm embarrassed to admit this. I write, by the way, you see in the, you saw probably in the dedication of the book that my kids and my wife think it's endlessly amusing that I wrote a book on how to overcome indecision, because they'll tell me you're like the king of indecisiveness. So I just finally pulled the trigger after like 6 months of research on like buying a new mattress, because I was like, the number of options, all the content out there, like, oh my goodness. And it, like, yeah, I know you give me a year sleep trial, but I don't want to return this thing. It's a pain. Like, and I don't want everyone looking at me saying, like, why is my back hurt in the morning? Like, it's, you know, but you made the wrong choice. So these are simple purchases. That was not a high dot ticket B2B purchase. That was a low ticket consumer purchase, relatively. And it still caused a lot of indecisiveness. And what we found in the research is these skills, we tested it against transactional, sales that were low dollar value, happened in maybe one or two calls, right? And high complexity, big ticket, long sales cycle, lots of stakeholders, et cetera. What we found is that the effect of these Jolt skills didn't vary at all. It is the same thing picking movie for movie night or buying a mattress all the way to signing off on $1 million software purchase or consulting agreement for your company, whatever it is. We also, though, found that the no decision loss rate does vary. That was, remember I said 40 to 60%. The reason for the range, Jim, is that in transactional sales, the no decision loss rate is actually higher. It's closer to 50, 60% because there are more window shoppers and tire kickers when there's a low investment required on the customer, right? What's the big deal? I'll do a call, maybe two calls, not a huge investment of time. if I'm going to go down the path of spending a year with a vendor evaluating a really complex high ticket B2B sale, I'm going to think twice. If I know I'm not going to do anything or we can't make the decision, I'll probably think twice before I waste everybody's time, including the vendor's time. But let's be honest, they're really concerned about wasting their own time and their colleagues' time. So the no decision loss rate in complex B2B is closer to 40, 50%, but still it's huge, right? It's 40 to 60. It's a lot.
Very huge. Matt Dixon, awesome conversation. And so, you know, hey, I guess for a lot of organizations, your silent killer, you know, of your sales, you know, can be answered. Make sure you pick up the Jolt Effect. Matt, how does the B2B DM gang get in touch with you?
Yeah, so definitely, I love getting connected with folks on LinkedIn. If you heard me on, if you're part of the B2B DM gang, you heard me on Jim's show, please let me know. Tell me you heard the podcast. And even if you didn't like it, you tell me why. But shoot me a LinkedIn message. Let's keep the dialogue going and stay in touch. And then the other thing I tell you is go check out jolteffect.com. There's a lot more about the research. There's a bunch of free tools, including coaching tools and things like that, that you can download on the site. And there's a lot that we're offering by way of enablement and training and different options, both that we deliver directly, but also delivered by our partners. So,
Matt Dixon, thank you for sharing your knowledge.
Thanks, Jim.
And we wish you the very best.
Yeah, very best to you as well.
Thank you for joining us. Go now to join the B2B DM gang in the B2B Marketer LinkedIn group, where you can connect with other B2B DM disruptors and get access to our B2B DM cheat sheets, checklist, and guides. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, please help by going to iTunes to rate, review, and subscribe. And share the show on all of your digital platforms. Be sure to tune in next week for our next episode. And always remember, you can automate your lead capture, but you must lure your lead.